today what I want to talk about is a joint research project between myself and Jonathan Cherry in St. Pat's. And we've been working on different aspects of this for a couple of years now, on and off, every time we have a break or need to take a break from something else. So we thought we'd pull out some of the issues around Southern Irish loyalism, unionism, using the three lost counties of Ulster to examine what the geography of the signing of the Solemn League and Covenant looks like in Ulster as a whole, and then maybe to see if we can pull out whether there are those variations in those three counties or not. And is it sufficient to claim that those three counties had kind of Southern Irish loyalist tendencies as early as 1912? And also because I suppose when we've been looking at this for a while, and we kind of get a little bit frustrated when people talk about how the centenary that we're remembering is 1913 to 1923, and we're like, what about the Ulster Covenant? So trying to make a claim for how that is actually a key part of all this and needs to be considered. So I'm not going to spend too long on the historical background, but just for people who aren't that familiar with the period, I suppose we're all aware that there are different waves of unionism, and the waves of unionism emerge as there are various home rule crises for the unionist community in Ulster. But the third home rule crisis is probably key. In the aftermath of the parliamentary crisis, the Lords' veto to block legislation is reduced to a maximum of 2 years or three successive readings of any piece of legislation. And it essentially makes home rule inevitable when the Home Rule Party are propping up the government. And it really mobilises Ulster. And Ulster has mobilised in each of the other two crises with large-scale demonstrations. But they tend to be of the upper classes, not necessarily just the landed in Ulster, but certainly the Ulster upper classes. This mobilisation is different. It's a grassroots mobilisation. And it's reflective of changes that we see happening across the board in nationalist and unionist communities in the early 20th century. And what we see, particularly from the turn of the century onwards, are people becoming more and more engaged in politics as the franchise increases, as local democracy is widened, as we get a much more representative sense of power structures, people become more politically aware, more politically engaged and more politically involved. And that happens across Ulster unionism as well. And that's been well documented, that shift. There's a military element to it, and in Ulster we see tensions rising from the parliamentary crisis onwards. There is a lot of drilling in Ulster, a lot of route marching in Ulster in 1910 and 1911. But what we also see is a more peaceful element of symbolic protest. So we see large-scale demonstrations where speakers come and talk to the gathered unionist masses. And these are big demonstrations. We're looking at about 12,000 people at a demonstration in Omagh in early 1912. 300,000 people turn up to Balmoral. Now, these numbers are coming from inspectors' reports. They're obviously open to critique, but it's giving you that sense of the scale of the nature. So it's large numbers in key symbolic locations. And so the Ulster Covenant kind of falls in as part of that. So we're talking about Southern Irish loyalism here, and obviously Ulster unionism, Ulster loyalism is somehow different to that Southern unionism. But for the very, or certainly into the early 20th century, there's an insistence that unionist viewpoints should be taken on board, that there should remain a sense of unity, and Southern unionists are prominent in the unionist movement, particularly because of Carson being the MP for Trinity College, as we've just been hearing about. But unionism in Ulster is a very different type of unionism because of the larger scale of the population, because it tends to be much more diverse in terms of its class base, but also because of the sectarian tensions that exist within Ulster. So it gives it quite a different colour. And by 1911, we see unionists saying we must be prepared the morning Home Rule passes ourselves to become responsible for the government of the Protestant province of Ulster. So very clearly setting out that Ulster is different. Ulster says no rhetoric that we're so familiar with. And the Ulster Unionist Council set about framing a constitution which they'll implement if they need to. The third Home Rule Bill is introduced on the 11th of April 1912, and it says that it'll make a special provision for Ulster, and this kind of opens the way to negotiations around what that special provision might be. But people on the ground are consistently questioning the legitimacy of the government to force measures on a population that don't want it. They are imperial citizens. They are part of the stronghold of the British Empire, and the British Empire that they support is ignoring their viewpoints. And we see that there's an increase in the political activity at that grassroots level, particularly through 1912. And there's a sense among the unionist leadership that there needs to be a statement made, and that it needs to focus the, I suppose, the activities of the Ulster Unionists, which are increasingly gearing towards militarisation. So they decide to hold a major celebration on Ulster Day on the 28th of September 1912. And we're all familiar with it as the day when Edward Carson signs the Covenant in City Hall in Belfast with the Union Jack over the table, that symbolic ritual, with key Unionist figures around him. What we're less aware of, and what we want to talk about today, is the fact that this is a provincial-wide celebration that takes place right the way across Ulster. 470,000 people signed the Covenant, the male version, and the Declaration, the female version, not just in Belfast, but in over 1,000 local venues, organised by over 1,500 different organising agents. So the organisation of the event in itself is a mass mobilisation. Now, there's two different texts because of the gendered nature of society, and we're not going to get too much into feminist geographies, but just to kind of highlight that there are these issues. We have the Solemn League and Covenant that's signed by the men, which specifically says that they're willing to use whatever force is necessary to support the union, whereas the women declare that they are willing to support the men in their attempts, so not actually linking to the physical force tradition. And these are the souvenir copies of the Covenant that people got after they signed so that they could hang them in their own homes in order to commemorate their involvement in that event. So what happens then as geographers, we talk about this as the symbolic appropriation of the Ulster landscape on the 28th of September 1912. Fitzpatrick calls it a matchless triumph of Irish political mobilisation. And it's certainly that. It's a grassroots mobilisation. The signings are preceded by religious ceremonies. So we get that link between religion and politics being really clearly announced by the Unionist population. Religious services in the morning, marches from the churches to the signing locations if they're not held in the churches. The marches are accompanied by bands, so you've got all that parade, the celebrity kind of nature of it. Buntings and flags hung in local areas, and you can see that's an example from Limavady there. Do I have a little pointer? Yeah, Limavady in the corner there, and you can see the flags and people in the outdoors locations. And this one is taken from Sion Mills with the ladies signing in all their finery. So when we started this project, we were interested to find out, where are these signings happening and is there a difference in terms of the geography across the province? What kind of locations are being used and who's doing this organising? Who are the key players in Ulster Unionist society in this period? So really what we've done is we've taken a digital humanities approach and we're making use of all the wonders of modern technology available to us, in other words, the internet. So we've taken the Ulster Covenant, which has been made available as a searchable database through Prony, online. And we've taken the 1911 census, which conveniently happens just a year before the Ulster Covenant is signed. And we're using both of those sources together to build up a picture of what Ulster Day was like. We took the eligible population from the census, and the eligible population was anybody who was aged 16 in 1912, so the 15-plus-year-olds in 1911, compared that with the signatures gathered. We created a table with all the sign-in locations, the organising agents and the number of signatories that they gathered, and then we used the census to look for the agents on the census to figure out who these people were and what their background was, and then we mapped the locations using their coordinates. And then we realised that this is a ridiculous idea and we should never have started it in the first place. Sounded great when we first sat down to talk about it. And a lot of our problems came about due to the poor standard of the digitisation transcription process through Prony. No, I mean, Prony have done a huge amount of work to make this available, so it's not to take anything away from that. But there does seem to have been multiple people working on the same boxes of sheets, which means that you get the same organising agent's name spelled five or six different ways, sometimes looking like a completely different name, and it's only when you actually open the sheets that you see that. So we discovered very early on that there was going to be lots of double checking that was required. So then we came across the illegible handwriting, the guesswork that other people were using when they were transcribing it that we then had to try and follow out. And then, of course, there were the people who weren't on the 1911 census and even more problematically weren't on the 1901 census, so we just couldn't track them down. And that was much more difficult when there was people of the same name in different localities, and we praised the fact that the smaller Protestant population with their very distinctive names made life an awful lot easier than it would have been to trace the Sweeneys and the Gallaghers around places like Donegal. Obviously, there's missing census information, But there's also a lot of covenant signings that just take place in an area. So they'll name a townland or a town without telling you exactly where. So that also proved slightly problematic. Some of the sheets are missing. Sometimes there's no agents or places recorded. And just to give you an idea of what we are missing, just so that everybody is aware of what the limitations are, we recorded through this process 438,394 signatories. Prony's own website says that there should be in Ulster 447,197. So we're about 8,000 shy, and we cannot find them on the digitised database. So we're in the process of trying to figure out where those numbers have gone so we can fill those in. So there is a little element. Now, it's not very significant compared to the 400,000, but it's significant enough nonetheless. So what are we looking at? If we're looking at the signatures per county, you can see here they're listed by county with the raw numbers as well as the percentages there, just to give you a sense of it. The highest is Antrim with 175,000 signatories. The lowest is Cavan with 8,000. And what we can see very quickly when you start looking around this, if you go around it clockwise, is the four key uncontested unionist counties of Antrim, Down, Derry, Armagh, followed by Tyrone. And then we get Donegal, Fermanagh, Monaghan and Cavan. So just bear in mind those four counties as we go through. Now, obviously, that's reflective of just the lower unionist population in those counties. So there's not, I'm kind of concerned about making any big statements about that because it is reflective of that population. If we break it down according to covenant and declaration signatures, just to see if there's a gendered element, the same pattern emerges apart from Tyrone and Armagh flip positions, but it's only by quite a small number. So the same general pattern is reflected regardless of the gender dimensions. If we map it according to the percentage of the eligible population, though, that's where we get a much better idea of how many people who could have signed the covenant actually did. So this is the percentage of people who were over 16 in 1912 that were entitled to sign, as opposed to the number of signatures. And this is where we see the pattern being not quite so clear-cut and being much more complicated. We see Armagh with the highest total, followed by Tyrone. Now, Armagh and Tyrone have come out as key active counties in other research that I've done on the GAA in the 21st century. So I'm just wondering, is it the contested nature of that those two counties with the opposing populations that gives rise to this kind of increased activity? I've no way of quantifying that at the moment. Low numbers in Down, but I think that's reflective of people in Down travelling into Belfast, into City Hall, to be there as part of that symbolic location. And then you've got the others. I mean, there's not a great range. If you take it from Donegal up to Armagh and just leave Down out of that equation, you're only looking at, what's that, 68, 78, about 18% of a range. I mean, it's not that big when you're looking at very different population structures across the province. And you can do it according to the different covenant and declaration figures. I didn't want to bore you with yet another pie chart, but what you can see here is we've again got Armagh, Tyrone and Fermanagh being key counties across the board, Monaghan sneaking into the declaration figures, but at the bottom we seem to have Cavan, Down and Donegal at all times across the board as those kind of three lower returning counties. So again, I'm going to draw on the troubled geographies just like the lads did to show what the religious landscape looks like in Ulster in 1911. And these are maps that are built at rural district level at this point. So they're quite localised and they do give you quite a good sense of where the population concentrations are. And it's not that terribly surprising. We see the concentration of the Presbyterian population in around Antrim and Down, a much larger concentration of the Church of Ireland population in the other swathe of kind of southern Ulster. And that's helpful to a point, but as geographers, we're trying to get a finer grain on it. These different administrative divisions cause unnatural breaks in local populations. And what I have found, although it's not from the 1911 census, is this map that was made by Germans in 1913, but they based it on the 1901 census for some bizarre reason. Now, what I want to do at some point is recreate this map, but I just haven't got around to it. And it seems to be at electoral division level, so it's a much finer level of detail. And you can really clearly pick out the pockets of, and I know it's not great quality, but you can see the really dark red areas are the key areas of unionist support. But they have different shades as it goes right the way across so that you can actually pick out the key areas in East Donegal and even around parts of South Donegal that are that slightly lighter green colour where you've got those unionist populations. So if that's where the unionist populations are, where are the signings happening at? And this is where the signings are happening at. And the answer is pretty much everywhere that you've got a unionist population cluster of any description, shape or form. So we get the spread going right the way across the province. Obviously a density in Belfast. Anyone who's looking at this gap here should object to my geographic absence. Lough Neagh got lost somewhere along the way. I meant to put a layer over the top of it, but I forgot, so apologies for that. But apart from that, the rest of the gaps that you see are either physical features or lack of population concentrations. And you can see that actually quite clearly when you compare with the two maps. So what I was quite interested in when I was looking at this more recently is this area between Derry and Tyrone, and just on the border here, this upland area in the Sperrins, where you can see from this map the lack of a significant unionist population, which you can't see from the rural district maps that tribal geographies have produced. So there is a call for this kind of deeper level of scale. So in terms of the locations that they used, we've got our numbers, 1,027 venues. Of those, 135 were male-only sign-in locations, 168 were women-only sign-in locations, and the rest were joint sign-in locations. And there's a big debate in the literature about the role of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council in organising the female sign-ins. And actually what our research has shown is that the Ulster Women's Unionist Council may have been involved, but they certainly didn't set up a significant number of their own sign-in centres through the Ulster Covenant. Massive range in the numbers collected, 41,000 in City Hall. The main declaration sign-in centre was the Old Town Hall. Some of those are Covenant signatures as well, though. The lowest two in Dundrod House in Antrim and the Chapel of East Portsallan. So you've got that whole range. An average of 426 signatures per location, but a massive range. 81 locations with over 1,000 people signing, 314 with 100 or less. So a very different picture. And we've basically gathered the different sign-in locations into the following categories. So church buildings, civic buildings, public spaces, the not specified, meeting halls, private homes that are opened up, and some of the landlords do open up their houses for the sign-ins, and schools. And they're kind of the main categories that we've come across. So plotting that out, we see a significant number of not specified, and we'll come back to that in a second. Church buildings being the next largest, then meeting halls, and then the rest is kind of smaller numbers. And that's not terribly surprising. We're looking at the available facilities that people in different communities have. What's interesting is when you map out those building types per county and you look at the unspecified numbers and where they're highest, which is Donegal, Monaghan, Fermanagh and Cavan, with much more of the sign-in centres in the other locations being public sign-in centres. So there's a sense that these unspecified locations are places where there aren't facilities available to the community, where they might be more ad hoc, where maybe somebody's travelling around the area gathering signatures rather than having this big sign-in event in key symbolic locations. Now that's something we need to dig a bit more deeply into, but it's certainly a possibility. And we've mapped that out, and the background, some of these maps are at a very early stage. The background of this map, as Jonathan said, could I have found any more ways to spell Derry at the top there? I'm taking no responsibility for this. This was a person that we had making the map, so I'm leaving all the responsibility at his level. But it does give you a sense of where those buildings are, and particularly the concentration of church buildings, basically in a line in the west of the province, just coming down here, skirting across Lough Neagh, and the concentration of those church buildings as those places for use in that part of the province. In terms of who the agents were, we identified 1,546 agents. Of those, we could only find 1,383 of them on the census. The ones that we couldn't find took the longest and drove us mad as we tried to find any way we possibly could. And unfortunately, quite a large number of the unidentifieds are women, which is unfortunate, but has a lot to do with the fact that they sign as Mrs. So-and-so or with their husband's initial, which makes it really hard to pinpoint who those people actually are themselves. The breakdown in terms of gender is 69% of the agents are men, 31% women. The average age is 43, but ranges from 15 to 87. So we've got the whole remit of the age profile organising these sign-in events in Ulster and across 21 different occupation categories. In terms of religion, it's probably not terribly surprising. The largest concentration is Church of Ireland, 42% Presbyterian, and then a smattering of the other religions thrown in for good measure. And we can see that coming across quite nicely. If you look at that in terms of the map here, what you can pick out is the concentration of Methodist agents right the way across, really, from Armagh across the Donegal border, that kind of brighter yellow colour there. Now, unfortunately, because of the way this has been mapped, and as I say, these are early stage maps, some of them are hidden where there's multiple agents in one location. So there are a few more Methodists around the edges of Donegal and also in Monaghan. But what's interesting from this map in terms of the three counties is the predominance of the two key religions and the lack of that religious diversity that we see in other places. In terms of gender and the number of agents in each county, again, we can see if we look at the raw numbers, we can see Antrim, Down, Derry and Tyrone all featuring highly. And if we look at the smaller numbers, we've got Donegal, maybe surprisingly Armagh, Monaghan, Fermanagh and Cavan. Armagh has a very different kind of a story. It organises its sign-ins in teams, so there's less agents, but they cover more ground, so it's kind of a misnomer to have that in there. So again, we see our kind of random four tailing off towards the edge. But again, when we look at the percentages, we see a different story. And actually what we see when we look at the percentages of each gender is a very clear urban-rural divide. So the areas with the more urban areas tend to have more women. And I think that's a symbol of the progressive nature of the politics in those more urban-centred areas, but also where women are allowed to join in the organising by the men in the sign-in centres where there are large sign-in centres with large numbers, whereas in the smaller rural areas it tends to be the man saying, well, I'm in charge of all this. Now, again, that's just an assumption, but it certainly seems to be a pattern that's emerging. In terms of their occupations, graphing 21 of these different categories is difficult, and I apologise, I had meant to condense this down a little bit. But if you just look at this side of the pie chart here, what you've got is about 50% of all agents from two classes, the clergy and people who are loosely involved in agriculture. So we've got everything from the landowners, the land agents, the farmers' sons and the farm labourers here in the green colours, and then the clergy up here, about 18% or so. So we've got a very serious concentration in two key occupation classes. But actually, in terms of grassroots mobilisation, in terms of the widening up of the unionist popular support, we've got this whole gamut of other occupations that are beginning to feature as key leaders of Ulster unionism in localities. Unsurprisingly, the professionals, the merchants and the clerks, but perhaps more surprisingly, people engaged in manufacture, industrial workers and service industries, as well as students. So we are seeing the whole across the board being involved in this particular project. Now, again, probably not the prettiest of maps, but it gives you a sense of, in particular, those two key occupation groups across the different counties. And what it's shown actually quite clearly is that if you take the line from between the green and the red up in the various different counties, is that we see a much greater diversity in the counties with large urban centres. So in rural areas, we're confined into the clergy and the agricultural classes, but in the likes of Down, in the likes of Derry and in the likes of Antrim, we're getting a much wider engagement by the population. Everywhere else, you're looking at around about 70% of the population engaged in either agriculture or clergy in terms of the agents. The other, just very quickly, what I wanted to pull out was the landowners that we see emerging. And the highest concentration of landowners, this is this dark green area, is in Cavan, followed by Donegal. Now, Monaghan is way down there on four, but actually just after Fermanagh on five. And again, so we've got our four counties. And landowners, for this purpose, had to self-identify. So we've taken this directly from the census. But as part of another chapter that we've been working on, we had actually done a bit more digging, and we managed to identify the female landed agents by going through the different male agents who said they were farmers but actually were landowners and linking that back. And what that shows is, again, this pattern of Cavan, Fermanagh, Monaghan and Donegal being key areas of difference. So we've got the landowning classes coming across strongly as agents in those four counties. Tyrone is also in there in that case. But what's also really clear is a sense of these four safe counties who don't really need the landed gentry to speak for them, who are very happy to look after their own position, as it were. So again, we've mapped that. That map needs a huge amount more work, I think. It does have Loch Ness on it, which is always good, but it is quite difficult to see what's going on there. But you can see the pattern of the pink crosses and the green symbols for the agricultural workers. So condensed version of the classifications there, giving you some kind of an idea of the outline. So are the three lost counties different? And I suppose the answer is kind of. I'm very conscious that I'm reading a lot into these bar charts and that there's an awful lot more going on than what's just coming through from a straightforward, oh, these ones happen to be there at the outskirts. And there's certainly an argument to add Fermanagh in there, not so much Tyrone, which I thought was interesting because I've always been captured by Churchill's comment at the end of negotiations in 1914 about how he was delighted to leave the muddy byways of Fermanagh and Tyrone and who was going to get charge of them and whatever settlement emerged. And I think there's definitely a cause for Fermanagh to be considered more like those other three counties. Not that I'm suggesting that we should, you know, go in and recolonise Fermanagh or anything. But what they all have in common is that they are smaller, minority-driven communities. They're more isolated. The communities tend to be clustered in certain pockets. They're rural-based communities. They certainly appear to be more conservative, and they're definitely less diverse than what we see in the other more urbanised, industrialised parts of the province. There's a dependence on the clergy and the agricultural classes, and indeed the landowning classes, that suggests that the new wave of unionism hasn't got there yet. It's certainly in the urban areas, but it's not making its way through to those areas yet. And from looking at the buildings that they used and the unspecified nature, they certainly seem to have a lower keyed display on Ulster Day, with less use of public buildings and that symbolism. And that's backed up by newspaper reports. There are shopkeepers in Donegal who don't want to actively state that they've signed the covenant in case they offend their customers. So you've got that kind of local nuances at play. But they are equally willing to stake their claim of loyalty, and they do that in the same kinds of numbers and percentages as their fellow Ulstermen. So I'm hoping what we've at least made some kind of a case for today is that 1912 is actually a key part of this whole process and needs to be looked at in order to better understand what's going on in Ulster as we get into this decade that we're so busy commemorating at the moment. It certainly is part of the mass mobilisation of the unionist population across Ulster. It's a mobilisation that takes place regardless of gender, religion, occupation. More women sign the covenant than men. Women are equally, maybe not equally involved, but they are certainly participants in the organisation. So it unites the different factions in Ulster unionism. And it's a peaceful focus for an increasingly restless and militarising population. It operates also as a key point in that transition from unionism of the upper classes for the upper classes to unionism of the grassroots for the grassroots. And we can see that continuing throughout that period. It's also used as a key criteria in deciding who can and can't join the UVF when it's established in 1913. Did they sign the covenant or not? And it does legitimise the all means necessary approach that becomes increasingly popular across Ulster as we move through 1913 into 1914. Thank you.